Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
It's Brian Lehrer, and this is my Daily Politics Podcast from WNYC Studios. It's Tuesday, July 7th. Now, Princeton historian and CNN political analyst Julian Zelizer. In a CNN commentary over the weekend, he cited this from President Trump's Mount Rushmore speech as a centerpiece of the president's reelection strategy as Trump stood before the giant stone carvings of slaveholders and talked about the opposition.
Our nation is witnessing a merciless campaign to wipe out our history, defame our heroes, erase our values, and indoctrinate our children. Angry mobs are trying to tear down statues of our founders, deface our most sacred memorials, and unleash a wave of violent crime in our cities.
Now, obviously, not everybody carved on Mount Rushmore was a slaveholder, and that's not all they were, those who were, but that's why Trump chose that spot to pick that fight in the culture wars. Now, as a historian, Julian Zelizer writes that Trump is wrong if he thinks engaging in the complex realities of our nation's past is an act of wiping out our history. Zelizer also has a new history book about part of the road to the Donald Trump era. It's called Burning Down the House: Newt Gingrich, the Fall of a Speaker, and the Rise of the New Republican Party. Thanks for coming on, Professor Zelizer. Welcome back to WNYC.
Thanks for having me.
With your political analyst hat on first, why do you think Trump believes that standing unambiguously with monuments to the Confederacy, not just Mount Rushmore, but monuments explicit to the Confederacy, is his path to reelection in Wisconsin, in Michigan, in Pennsylvania, the key battleground states?
Well, the president obviously believes that this kind of backlash politics has weight in certain parts of the electorate, certain parts of the electorate that have been loyal to him. And from his view, these kinds of arguments will solidify support in what's been a difficult time for him politically. It also is a great way to take attention away from all the problems with the pandemic and get people to talk about statues rather than, Americans who are suffering, dying, and trying to rebuild their society after many months of lockdown.
What's the meaning of Mount Rushmore in this context with the stone carvings of Washington, Lincoln, Jefferson, and Theodore Roosevelt that led Trump to choose that venue?
Well, I think for him, it's his effort to present himself as the person standing to defend tradition, to present himself as a conservative who wants to uphold the values and symbols of the country. And I think that's why he's trying to do that. I don't think it's accurate. I don't think the arguments he's making really captures what's at stake. But that's what's behind the theater.
Trump seems to want to create his own little Mount Rushmore with his proposal over the weekend of a national park with new statues that he would call the National Garden of American Heroes. You wrote a commentary about this, and he proposed to include Washington and Martin Luther King, plus Ronald Reagan, Antonin Scalia, evangelist Billy Graham, frontiersman Davy Crockett, and baseball player Jackie Robinson, among others. What is that list of heroes, according to Trump, add up to or signify politically?
Well, the act itself is simply an extension of what we're talking about. His attempt to use the statues, his attempt to use the cultural wars as a wedge to regain some standing in the electorate. The actual people, it's a mishmash of people, frankly. It's unclear why some would be left off, like Franklin Roosevelt, and why others would necessarily be included, like Scalia. Some seem to be an effort to send a signal to conservatives. Others are an attempt, I think, to show that it's not all conservative and that he's trying to capture the whole range of American history. But again, we have to take this proposal in the context of what he's been doing. This is a political act. And again, it's an effort to pit himself against those who are challenging the history of racism and social injustice in this country.
How do you see the way he uses the black people on his list, MLK and Jackie Robinson are the two that I see, to insulate himself from running a campaign that, as you describe, seeks to play on white grievance primarily?
Well, if he had offered a list simply of white Americans, it wouldn't have been very subtle, especially in the context of what's happening. So I don't know the intentions of why those two selections were made, but it's hard not to assume there were political calculations to it. And you've heard already, when there is criticism, those are the two figures that his supporters often point to show that this is a very inclusive list.
And before we go on to some other things, to stay on the statues for just a second, you also mentioned that Trump said selected, or I shouldn't say stat, well, yeah, proposed statues for his Garden of American Heroes. Trump said selected non-Americans could be included, but his examples were Christopher Columbus, so he's repicking that fight, and Juniper Serra, an 18th century Catholic friar from Spain, canonized by Pope Francis a few years ago, I believe, but who had a statue torn down in San Francisco last month in Golden Gate Park because Serra is seen by some as a violent colonizer of Native American land. Do you know the Juniper Serra story as a historian?
I don't know much more about it than what you described, but I think the description, as well as that statue being taken down, explains very precisely why he included that in the list.
I think that's right. And did you see that someone tore down a statue of Frederick Douglass in Rochester, New York, over the weekend? So we now have statue assaults based on anti-racism responded to by statue assaults based on racism, not equivalent.
No. Look, I think there's other ways to handle this debate. I think there's a very legitimate debate to be had over not the Douglass statue, but some of these other statues, certainly the Confederate statues. There's great clarity on why those are so offensive to have in the way that they were put up, really as a slap in the face to the civil rights efforts of the last century plus. And then there are these other historic figures, founders and others, who were steeped in the institution of slavery. And I think that's a debate that we're going to continue to have for some time.
You make a contrast with conservatives in other countries moving toward the center in a conciliatory fashion with the reckoning that's taking place really around the world right now. Not in the U.S., though. What's a country you had in mind?
Well, there's a new book, Let Them Eat Tweets, that I had just read by Jacob Packer and Paul Pearson. They talk in England, they talk about the Tories, and they try to argue that conservatives, who often have economic policies that are really disconnected from what a lot of the country wants, do make conciliatory measures, whether it's raising taxes or accepting certain social safety net programs, realizing that you need some kind of coalition to survive. And we've seen a very different path, such as right now, where instead here in the United States, conservatives keep playing much more almost entirely to the extremes of their party and giving very little effort to make such conciliatory moves.
Let's take a phone call first, responding to some of what we've been talking about with respect to the statues. Lewis in Queens, you're on WNYC. Hello, Lewis.
Hi. Well, Charles Cook wrote an article in National Review Online, which just a few days ago, I think was on the 5th, and he disputed what I think her name is Tammy Duckworth said about the speech.
Senator,
it was very
Tammy
misrepresenting.
Duckworth.
When he didn't mention the Confederacy at all, it was more a speech about the Revolution, not the Confederacy. And I'll just read you a short quote. Declaration of Independence, quote-unquote, appears in the speech three times. Revolution and Founders appears four times. 1776 appears five times. The phrase, all men are created equal, is singled out as a set of immortal words that, quote, set in motion the unstoppable march of freedom. By contrast, Confederacy, quote unquote, isn't there at all, nor are Stevens, Davis, Lee, or Forrest.
So, Lewis, let me tell you.
The Civil War are vehicles for the adult adulation of Abraham Lincoln and the Emancipation Proclamation. That's just one paragraph.
Right. Well, let me tell you why that might be a sleight of hand, and you can respond. The major controversy regarding statues in the United States and military-based names, for that matter, has to do with the Confederacy. Remember, Trump went to Charlottesville back then and talked about how there were good people on both sides. The good people.
Wait.
The good people he was talking about on the conservative side were those who were there, who were nonviolent, who were defending the statue of Robert E. Lee at that time. And if we were to separate all the other categories, the Washington and Juniper Serra and just leave the Confederacy, we would have the same culture war going on, and so he doesn't have to say it. He's signaling very clearly. Lewis, respond if you disagree.
Okay. He's talking about the good people in the context of they weren't violent. They were good people, they were bad people. The violent people were the white supremacists. And he's
right, but that's what I'm saying. For him, the good people there were the people who were supporting continuing to glorify Robert E. Lee.
Can I speak?
You may speak.
May I speak?
You're speaking.
All right. In that speech, which is quoted all the time and it's shown on clips on every news show, he's saying there were good people and bad people. And then he goes on to say, I'm not talking about this white supremacist. That part of that clip is never played. And that is very disingenuous. And you yourself, when you have guests on, let them get away with that misrepresentation.
You're still not disputing that it's a misrepresentation, because the good people who he's talking about are people who are defending the continued glorification of the leader of the Confederate Army. So, Lewis, thank you for your call. Call us again. And Professor Zelizer, would you like to weigh in on that exchange?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's right in that, first of all, the heart of this debate has been about Confederate statues that were put up, again, as an act of defiance toward the idea of racial justice. That's what the heart of the whole debate has been about. I think the president, politically, shrewdly, has now connected it to this other debate and almost presented it as if it's really about statues of Lincoln and George Washington primarily. And that eludes the major debate that is going on. And if you look at the language of the speech, he's calling those who are criticizing the monuments radicals, assaulting our democratic tradition. He's using pretty blistering language about what this effort to raise questions of social justice is about. So I don't think that's a fair characterization of what he said. And context matters. This is in the context of his ongoing comments about those other Confederate statues as well.
So why'd you write a book today about Newt Gingrich, who served in Congress in the 1980s and 90s?
I started writing it really during the Obama presidency, trying to understand more of the roots of the Tea Party and the kind of Republican Party that was becoming very apparently the powerhouse of Washington. And I've studied a lot about American history, and I've always thought that Newt Gingrich was really a crucial figure in terms of, in the post-Watergate period, introducing this new kind of aggressive smash-mouth partisanship, which we see all the time today, and we see even more with President Trump in the White House.
Gingrich's district was suburban Atlanta. What was going on there in the 1980s and 90s that made them want that kind of smash mouth, as you say, politician?
Well, this is an area, the district, and that area of the country where Republicans had been pretty absent for a long time. And the older Southern Democrats who dominated that place were becoming less relevant, and you had these new suburban...
They were segregationist Democrats previously, right?
Sure, absolutely. And so Republican voters in a district like his and Republicans in Washington were thirsty for politicians who could bring them into power, who could win. And that was Gingrich's basic promise. I will do anything necessary to make Republicans a majority party in my district, in the South, but also on Capitol Hill.
The Democrats controlled the House of Representatives from the 1950s until the Gingrich-led campaign in 1994. I think a lot of people don't realize how long that went on. From, I think, 1954, if I'm not mistaken, until 1994, 40 years. After 2 years of Bill Clinton's presidency, however, and the Gingrich-led campaign for Republicans in the House, they took it over at that time. So give us both halves of that. Like, by today's standards, it's remarkable that one party could win a House majority 40 years in a row. Why was it possible? Even through the Republican presidencies, and we remember there were Republican presidencies, Richard Nixon and Ronald Reagan, each elected twice, each won in a landslide in their reelection campaigns, and yet the Democrats continued to take the House at those times. And then what was it about Clinton or about swing vote America nationally in 1994 that gave Gingrich the opening to flip it?
Well, I mean, part of what happened, Democratic ideas still were very enduring in large parts of the country. A lot of the policies of the New Deal in the 1930s and the Great Society in the 1960s had hold in many parts of the country, even in some southern parts, the non-civil rights elements of the agenda. And this was important to why House Democrats could outlive Eisenhower or even Ronald Reagan and maintain their power. Part of it, they were also a very strong, well-organized machine. And they had developed an apparatus with fundraising, with districting, that kept them in power. And that's why Gingrich convinced many of the party establishment, party leaders, who were more civil in their politics, to go along with what he wanted to do, to really use a much more blistering set of words to describe what Democrats were about, and to go on the media and attempt all kinds of theatrics to really present Democrats not as this enduring majority, but as a corrupt machine that had to be brought down.
And the downfall of a speaker is the subtitle of your book. And I think that not that doesn't refer to Newt Gingrich's downfall after he was speaker, but to Democratic Speaker of the House, Jim Wright, a Texas Democrat, who Gingrich led a successful campaign to disgrace and forced to resign. Why is Jim Wright, who I think is only a footnote in history, central to your telling of the Newt Gingrich story?
Well, it's because of his downfall that Gingrich moves from being this maverick political bomb-throwing Republican who many Republican leaders at least rhetorically say we have to stay away from. And then in 1987, 88, and 89, Gingrich leads this successful campaign, taking very kind of small, murky questions about Wright's ethics and blowing them up into another Watergate, essentially, and creating enough of a frenzy that he's pressured to step down and resign, which is exactly what he does. And it's because of this, it's because of his success at bringing down the speaker, first time it had happened in American history, that the Republicans elect him into a leadership position. And they make him the House Minority Whip, and that's the path to the speakership, that's the path to the modern GOP. So that successful moment and the Democrats' inability to fend him off, that's how Gingrich became the person he is.
Jeremy in Brooklyn, you're on WNYC with Julian Zelizer. Hi, Jeremy.
Hi. I want to thank the author for revisiting this critical point. I think of Gingrich as, in a way, as kind of the original, the OG troll from the right. And I wanted to ask his opinion about Gingrich's appearance on the documentary 13th. A lot of people are rewatching that documentary, and Gingrich is kind of coming off as a critic of the war on drugs. Is his reputation, is he attempting to whitewash his reputation? I'll take my answer off there.
Well, I mean, the funny thing about Gingrich on policy, he was pretty eclectic. I mean, he did agree with most of the Reagan Revolution, more money toward fighting communism in Central America, cutting the social safety net, cutting taxes. But there were these issues where he didn't totally fit in that revolution. On the environment, for example, he was much more pro-environment in the 1980s than the place many Republicans were. And he did raise questions about certain areas of criminal law enforcement that other Republicans had agreed to. But what I argue is his major kind of contribution isn't on policy, it's on strategy. And he's the one who pioneers this idea that partisanship can include just tearing down institutions, destroying governing norms, if that meant that it offered a path to power.
Connie in Croton on Hudson, you're on WNYC with Julian Zelizer. Hi, Connie.
Hi. Years ago, in a job that I no longer have, I attended meetings that were bipartisan meetings of members of Congress. This is in the early 2000s. And one of the things that I was told there was that Gingrich changed structural aspects of how Congress operated, that he went to a shorter work week to prevent people from socializing on the weekends across party lines, and that people were punished for working across party lines in terms of committee assignments and committee chairmanship. So that there were not just a kind of rhetorical strategy, but a structural strategy to really divide and change the way in which Congress operated.
That is true. I mean, he did that as Speaker, obviously, after 94. But one of the things I write about is that when he's a young legislator in the early 80s, he's constantly writing these memos to the leadership of the Republican Party, telling them that bipartisanship was irrelevant. And he says that basically Democrats intended to act bipartisan, but what that meant was that they would use the spirit of bipartisanship, he wrote at one point, to maintain control of the House. And he would tell senior Republicans all the time, he would say, you have to teach Republicans to be more aggressive, you have to teach them to be more confrontational. And he didn't believe that bipartisanship was something Republicans should adhere to. And he was willing to do all these actions that made bipartisanship impossible. So when he became Speaker in 94, he put into practice all these ideas that he'd been talking about since the 1980s.
So before you go, give me a thought on COVID politics right now as they pertain to President Trump. With these spikes taking place, they're starting to talk about pressure on the hospitals now in Miami and in Houston, which supposedly wasn't happening when the spikes were largely, as they are largely, among younger people. But I think the prevailing thought among the Republican governors of Texas and Florida, maybe also Arizona, was as long as the hospitals weren't getting overrun, the better course for more people was to still keep the state's economies relatively open. Now they're having to backtrack, and because it's getting so serious. But my question is really pertaining to the president. As he tries to run to his base, and his base includes older white people around the country and certainly in these swing states, those states that are swing states, it's older people who are most at risk from serious repercussions of COVID. And here he seems to be leading the charge to downplay it, to minimize it, to say 99% of the cases are harmless, he said just the other day. That's a lie. And to, downplay the wearing of masks and to try to pull people together in large, even indoor gatherings. I mean, frankly, he's a murderer, according to a lot of his critics at this point. And I wonder if that the seriousness of the implications of what he's been doing with respect to COVID are in play.
Well, they are. I think we're watching in real time how the failed policies of an administration to deal with a major crisis are undercutting our ability to recover from the crisis and are resulting in huge amounts of human loss of life. The administration has kept putting forward arguments that don't really make sense. You can't reopen the economy unless you've seriously contained the pandemic and committed to policies to keep containing it. That's what we're seeing right now. The reopenings in Florida, in Texas, they weren't real. And they were really going to be short-lived from the beginning. And I think the virus is respreading. It feels like we are in a place that we were in early March, now with discussions of further lockdowns. And it's a question in terms of the politics. Can the president survive and outlast the problems that are very clearly in front of the nation and the inability to stop this? But the idea of reopening the economy, reopening the schools without containing the pandemic, that's just based on really a myth of how this is all going to work.
Julian Zelizer, Princeton historian and CNN commentator, is now the author of Burning Down the House, Newt Gingrich, The Fall of a Speaker, and the Rise of the New Republican Party. Thanks as always.
Thanks for having me.
Brian Lehrer, a daily politics podcast, is obviously also a daily coronavirus podcast under the circumstances in our country right now. We'll keep staying on top of things to serve you the best we can. And remember, this podcast is excerpted from my live weekday call-in show, The Brian Lehrer Show. If you want to be a caller or just hear it live, it's from 10 a.m. to noon Eastern Time on WNYC Radio in New York or online at WNYC.org. You can also tweet a question at us anytime. Just tweet at Brian Lehrer. Thanks for listening today.